The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Welcome, welcome again. It's nice to see you all here. So tonight I'd like to start with a little story. It's just a brief little story that's in the Vasuddhimagga. This is a little bit later than the Pali Canon. And I'm embellishing this story, so this isn't it verbatim. But it goes like this. So imagine that you're in the desert and you don't have any water. And you have some distance to travel and it's pretty precarious. And then as you're traveling, you come over a little rise into the distance. You see, like, oh, that looks like that might be palm trees. But you're not sure. It might be a mirage. So you head that direction. And you notice, yeah, okay, it seems pretty steady. Those palm trees are still there. As you start walking, you start encountering people, and they have wet hair. And they're carrying bundles of wet clothes. So this gives you some encouragement, like, okay, this is an oasis. It's just right over there. And you get really excited, having been in the desert and then saying, okay, here's an oasis. So you keep on walking, you arrive, and it's beautiful. There's this big lake of this cool water. And you feel so happy. Like, oh, it's here. Plenty of water. Nice and cool here. There's shade under the trees. And then you drink the water. You jump in the lake. You get cleaned up. You get refreshed. You get out. Feeling really contented, happy. And then you lie down in the shade of a tree and have a rest. You're not asleep. Maybe you're just resting against the tree. Maybe you're not lying down, but there's a certain amount of contentment that arises. This certain feeling of, okay. Not a lot of troubles, but just happy to be there. So, this desert, crossing the desert without water, might sometimes feel like our practice, our life, that there's this burdensome and difficult and not feeling nourished, not feeling like we have enough. And this sense that we have to go somewhere, we have to go across this sandy desert that's not so easy to walk on sand sometimes. There's this relentless heat, and maybe you're even feeling a little bit lost, not sure where you're going. And then this idea of glimpsing an oasis. Glimpsing, oh, there might be something here that can be a support, that can be something that's nourishing and find some respite from the heat and from this thirst. Maybe in our practice, maybe this was early in our practice, recognizing that maybe mindfulness is a place that can provide some benefit or provide some nourishment in some kind of way. But in the beginning, we often just have this glimpse of it, and we don't necessarily trust it. But we have a glimpse enough that we're willing to keep on going. And then when we have seen others who are coming with the wet hair or with bundles of wet clothes or something, that's kind of like being inspired by maybe coming to a meditation center, maybe meditating with others, and seeing, oh, there's others who practice this way. They seem happy, relaxed, or however, or satisfied, or they have wet hair. And at that moment, that's what you're looking for, is wet hair. When you're in the desert, hot, feeling like you're thirsty. So we see clues that aren't just, that are just a little bit more than these little glimpses that we might have with mindfulness. And there's a certain delight. There can be a certain uprising of, maybe this is for me too. And then when we arrive at the oasis, I realize there's plenty of water, plenty of water. There's this feeling of happiness, like, okay, here's, I can stay here for a while and drink some of this water and feel like I, like, supported and nourished by it. And then we also dive in the water, we feel refreshed, and there's something inside of us that starts to settle, like, oh, okay, there's something here that can be helpful for me. Then we have this certain amount of contentment. Often we think about this contentment arises because we got what we wanted. We wanted some water. But I'd like to encourage us to think about another way to interpret this, is the contentment arises is because we are no longer have this strong desire for water. It's the ending of the desire, that wish for something different than what we're having, that allows us some contentment rather than just getting what we want. So often in our lives, we do actually get what we want. But have you noticed how it doesn't really, the satisfaction for that doesn't last very long? We do get to sleep in sometimes. We do have good meals sometimes. The weather is beautiful sometimes. Right? We do get these things that we want. But it never seems quite enough. So the contentment is not just because we got what we want, but because there's the desire has been abated, the desire has been rested. And there's more than one way to let the desire quiet, to let it soften. I'm going to talk a little bit more about this, but still I want to kind of say something about this, this story. After drinking the water, diving in the water, then this idea of, like, maybe leaning against one of these palm trees and taking a rest. Maybe we're not sleeping, but now just viewing and seeing what else is happening at this oasis. This recognition that nothing else needs to be done right now. We got here. We have some water. Presumably there's some food too, or maybe we already had food with us. And so there's no sense of urgency if things have to be different, no pushing or pulling, kind of, you know, like pushing, trying to shove our experiences away, or pulling, trying to keep our experiences with us, but just relaxed under the tree. And so from this place of relaxing underneath the tree, we can see things differently than if when we were feeling lost in the desert. So literally we see things differently. In the case of this story, we see the water, we see the palm trees. But we all have this experience too, that when we're hungry and tired or didn't sleep well or got bad news or whatever it might be, then we see things a particular way compared to when we feel content, relaxed, happy. We see things a different way. In the case when we're a little bit grumpy, and because we haven't eaten or we're tired or whatever it might be, then maybe we tend to kind of like look at the negative side or have a little bit more contracted view. But when we're relaxed and feel content, a certain amount of contentment, then this can be a little bit more open, our view, what we see, what we're noticing. And not only that, there can be a little bit more steadiness. This feeling like, oh, things are okay. Yeah, okay, the kids are really loud when they're playing in the water over there, but it's okay. Whereas, you know, if we were in a little bit of a bad mood, we might get really irritated about the kids playing in the water, for example. So we could say that Buddhist practice is about just this being able to see things differently, to create the conditions in which there can be this being able to see the bigger picture, and to have a certain amount of steadiness, to not feel like we're being buffeted or pushed around by our experiences, but to have a little bit more relaxed and open perspective and to see what's arising and what's really happening, as opposed to just being caught and consumed with the difficulties. And to no longer have this enchantment of, or lost in stories about how things are or how we wish they were, but to actually see how they are. So in this story, there's a certain amount of joy and happiness that supports the arising of this contentment, that supports the arising of being able to see clearly. So joy and happiness are an integral part of practice, but they're not the point of practice. We need them. We need them for our life, but they're also a support for practice. Partly because they help create the conditions in which there can be a certain amount of relaxation, a certain amount of openness, so that we can see a little bit bigger. So our spiritual path isn't only about having great experiences. Our meditation practice isn't only about having wonderful meditative experiences. We all know that these experiences cannot be sources of lasting happiness. They can bring pleasure and there can be happiness, but they're not sources of lasting happiness. In contrast, being able to see things clearly can be a source of lasting happiness when we start to see how things really are and to put down the stories we have or the busyness in the mind that we have that prevents us from seeing. So this seeing the bigger picture with a certain amount of steadiness, we could call this equanimity. And the Pali word is upekkha, and etymologically, we could say that upekkha means to be look upon. And one way, one reason why I kind of like this way of understanding upekkha as look upon is to highlight that it's different than look away. It's look upon. Because sometimes equanimity, people think like, well, it's a certain amount of indifference or detachment or coolness or indifference or something like that. And I would say, no, that's more about looking away. But equanimity is born out of this joy and happiness and contentment. It's not the only way to get to equanimity. It's one way. And it's about to look upon. So seeing the big picture, not just what we're concerned with at that moment, but to be able to see what other people are doing, what's happening with them. To see that not only is maybe the children are really loud that are playing, but also it's comfortable underneath this tree. And maybe I feel a little bit hot, but I'm not thirsty. So we don't get stuck on the things that are unpleasant or stuck on the things that are pleasant, but be able to see the whole range. There's perfectly neutral things happening, unpleasant things happening, and pleasant things happening. So in some ways, we might imagine, I talked about it, this contentment is kind of like leaning against the tree, but maybe it's more about being at the top of a hill, and then you can see, you know, further. You can see a little bit wider. Maybe that's a better way to imagine kind of this idea of upekkha. And so upekkha has this awareness of whatever is happening. It's connected to what's happening, seeing what's happening. But it also has this inner balance, this steadiness, this being connected to the foundation. In some ways, we can think of it like how sailboats have keels. I'm not a sailor. I know that Jim is a sailor here, but a keel, my understanding is, you know, this blade, I'll call it a blade, that's underneath the boat that helps it to not tip over when the winds are pushing on it. So equanimity in some ways is like having this keel that allows us to experience the winds. The winds are still there, but we're not going to tip over with them. It helps keep the boat upright. So it's this steadiness of mind and steadiness of heart in the face of still being connected with whatever's happening. All of our inner and our outer experiences. So not only what we see out there, is the way I was describing it, but also what we see in here, our experiences. Maybe we notice that some impatience with equanimity, like, okay, it's just impatience. We don't have to add a story on, I'm a bad person. I've been practicing all these years, I shouldn't be impatient, or something like that. And so with equanimity, it makes our lives easier, of course it does, not being pushed around so much by our experiences. Whether our experiences include the news cycle or difficulties with finances or partners or our inner life, feelings of confusion or despair or racing thoughts, troubling thoughts, whatever it might be. But equanimity allows us to not stumble around or be pushed around by these. Recently, I had to take some medication that for a little while that I knew was going to make me feel a little bit off. I'll just use this vague word, off, because that's what it felt like. And somehow just like having this knowledge, like, okay, I don't feel so great, but it's just because I'm taking this medication. Just that kind of a knowledge allowed me to like, okay, that's just how it is right now. So sometimes just being able to see the bigger picture, seeing that, oh, things, there's conditions for what's arising. There are reasons for what's arising. And sometimes having that understanding can help us to have the steadiness of equanimity. So in this way, equanimity helps us to see bigger, but seeing bigger also helps us to understand the conditionality, maybe, right? No guarantees, but we can see like, oh, okay, of course I feel this way. I didn't sleep well last night. I'm taking this medication, whatever it might be. So equanimity also helps us to see more deeply into our experience with the steadiness of heart, the steadiness of mind. In some way, equanimity can be like a tripod that allows a telescope, or it could be like a microscope that allows us to see more deeply, something that we wouldn't be able to see just with our regular busyness or regular ways of interacting with our environment. And so what do we see when we see things more deeply? We see that they're changing. There's so many different ways we can talk about changing. There's can be the all these different time scales, right? Things that have the nature to arise have the nature to pass away. Things that have the nature to be born have the nature to die. But also, there can be when the mind is really quiet and really settled, we can start to see that there's a little bit of a flickering of our experiences. The things aren't as steady and solid as we might imagine them to be. So equanimity helps us to see this quality of our experiences. Unlike this sense of like something being stuck and impenetrable or unable to really have a way in which there's any flexibility. Instead of that, we can see, oh yeah, okay, this isn't as solid as I thought it was. This uncomfortable experience in my knee when I'm sitting, maybe that's not just this pain, but with equanimity we could see that we have the patience, we have the capacity to just be with the experience a little bit longer and to see the flickering quality of it. We also can see that our experiences are not inherently satisfying. To be sure, there are pleasant experiences and there are unpleasant experiences, but we still haven't quite found, you know, that experience that's going to be a source of lasting happiness. And with seeing more deeply, we start to see even those things that we were pretty sure were going to make our life better, make things happy or satisfying in some way. We start to see, oh yeah, even those aren't as satisfying. And we find that even though we might be chasing after things, thinking that this is going to be the thing that's going to make me happy, with some steadiness we can see, oh, yeah, actually it doesn't make sense to hold on to this thing, this that promise of this experience, the promise of this object. Because it's not as steady as I thought it was. Then naturally our relationship to those objects or those experiences shift. It's just natural. We don't have to make it happen. And we just are not holding on so tightly. And then when we're not holding on so tightly, there can be more ease, more freedom, more spaciousness. And as we do this and as we kind of explore our experiences with a mind and a heart that have some equanimity, we start to understand our experiences more fully. And we start to see that every time there's a liking of something, that means there's a disliking of something else. It's just impossible to not have one without the other. And so we start to see like, oh yeah, chasing after our preferences just really highlights everything that isn't our preference, instead of just having a little bit more open and relaxed view about things and not having to be so much spending our energy and our time trying to just surround ourselves exclusively with our preferences. So this not chasing after our preferences, seeing things aren't quite as satisfying, seeing that there are changes, as I said, creates this conditions in which there can be this letting go, this kind of little bit more spaciousness. That alone allows the mind to be even more unagitated. And liberation, freedom, is an unagitated state. So in this way, spending some time with equanimity, cultivating equanimity, recognizing equanimity, is a way in which we are kind of like the goals and the means get similar. If freedom is unagitated and equanimity is a type of unagitation, we can see where equanimity is a helps support the type of letting go that supports liberation, as well as itself being an experience that's similar to liberation in the same family. So sometimes we might think as a concept, equanimity just might seem unappealing. Some people say that they don't really want equanimity. It sounds boring. It sounds flat. Instead, they might want this juiciness, this gusto, this of the joy, and or we want the excitement of experience, or we might this passionate involvement with life. And it might sound like, sometimes when we hear this word equanimity, it might feel like there's a sort of disconnection or not caring. And to be sure, indifference sometimes masquerades as equanimity. And there will be times in our practice when we slide into indifference, when we kind of disconnect from our experience and we're feeling a little bit shut down, and maybe we're feeling a little bit cold and removed. That's natural, this happens, but that's not equanimity. That's more indifference. And in some ways I might say that it's important for us to have that experience, to have this indifference arise, to recognize, oh, this is what it feels like to be disconnected. This is what it feels like when there's might be some less agitation, but there's also a sense of disconnection or not caring, or arises when there's a little bit of aversion has arisen. So sometimes we might even call this aversion, but it can feel, we might have this idea that that's what equanimity is, but instead, equanimity has this sense of aliveness, this sense of vitality, this sense of connection, that's with some openness and spaciousness and warmth. But another reason why equanimity might not sound like it's something we're so interested in is because we might come to believe that there might be this underlying belief that we're not so sure what would our life be like if we didn't have lots of drama in some way or other. The drama of getting rid of some difficulty, or the drama of defending one's sense of self, or the drama of bolstering one's sense of self, make sure we look good to everybody. I'm using this word drama. Sometimes it is dramatic. Sometimes it's really subtle also, these types of things. But maybe we're a little bit unsure what would be there if we didn't have this. Maybe I could use the word busyness, this busyness of trying to get rid of the difficulty, solve some problem, trying to bolster this self, make ourselves look good. So that might be another reason why there might be some hesitation, or maybe this idea that, I don't know, equanimity just doesn't sound so interesting. But I would like to say that what we all really want is some stable sense of well-being that can't be shaken by circumstances. And this arises when we have some equanimity. In some ways, like the mind with equanimity is like a mountain, that it remains there even when there's tornadoes or hurricanes or these types of things. We might have this idea we want to be happy, and certainly we do. But what we're... there's this way in which always like searching for happiness, because things that we think are going to be happy turn out, make us happy, turn out not to make us happy. So then there's this relentless search, which might be subtle, but can you imagine what it might be like to have like this really radical contentment? It's okay. Everything's okay. I don't have to go fix that. It's not perfect. I don't have to fix it. I don't have to hold on to this. It's enjoyable, but I'll be okay if it goes. I think this is so much what human beings are really looking for. Maybe a place to rest, a place to feel safe. And a place that, in order to have that, it can't be susceptible to whatever's happening in the world or whatever's happening in our inner life. And I like this, just these few lines from the awakening poem from Subhuti. Subhuti was a monk at the time of the Buddha. And it was the tradition sometimes to capture these poems about when people had awakening experiences. And the way that he describes this reminds me of this idea of equanimity. So this part of his awakening verses goes like this. My little hut is roofed and pleasant, sheltered from the wind. So rain, sky, as you please. I don't know, there's something very sweet about this. I kind of like this, that he's roofed, that he's, he has this refuge, he has this shelter, and sheltered from the wind. I think many of us have heard about these eight worldly winds, these things that push us around, praise and blame, fame and disrepute, gain and loss, and pleasure and pain. And of course, we only want one half of all of those dyads, but every life gets both halves of those. We get all eight. There's nobody that's immune to this. But Subhuti talks about in his hut that's roofed and pleasant, sheltered from the wind. So rain, sky, or sky, rain, as you please. So he's not trying to make things be a particular way. Maybe it'll be sunny, maybe it'll be rainy, it's okay. But having the confidence that we can meet whatever might arise. So, equanimity, I talked about the way that, in this little story that I started with, is, you know, feeling like you're in the desert and then having the happiness and, or the joy of seeing the oasis, the happiness of having actually drunk from the oasis. So, that's one way in which we can have some equanimity, is to keep practicing when we encounter joy and happiness. There are moments, they may not be large, giant moments, but there are some moments of joy and happiness that do arise in our life. Yay, the weather's going to be great. Yay, the newspaper arrived on time in the morning. So if you for those of us who still read newspapers. I have them delivered. I was just visiting my mom recently, and she does. I have to say, I just love this, to go out in the morning and get the paper. I myself don't, but I just love this at my mom's house. So to keep practicing when we encounter joy and happiness, often we kind of like stop practicing. There's a way we might like stop being mindful, or we might feel like we don't need to practice anymore because maybe in some ways we feel like, oh, we arrived. We got what we wanted. We have this joy, we have this happiness, and that's the purpose of practice, so I'm going to stop. But there's an encouragement. Can we stay mindful? Can we still be with the experience? Not abandon ourselves with it. Experience it fully, but not forget practice in a relaxed, easy, gentle way. And this is a natural progression to go from joy, which tends to have a little more energetic feeling, happiness, which has a little more subtle, contented feeling, and then to equanimity. It doesn't always happen, but that's one way in. So just an encouragement to continue practicing when you are experiencing joy and happiness. Another way is to actually really cultivate this, I might say, this inner reservoir of well-being. This reservoir that can be a resource no matter what the circumstances are. So to spend time really noticing when there is any sense of well-being. That feeling that we get when we are generous to others. That feeling when we are letting those people close to us know how much we care about them. When we're doing loving kindness practice, maybe there's a way in which the heart opens. So really tuning into these experiences when they do arise. Maybe they're not that often. Maybe they're very often, whatever it is for you. Tuning in, it's just so that the heart and the mind remember that there is this capacity for this feeling of well-being. And so there's less fear about loss, for example, if there's a part of us that understands where deep happiness arises. Deep happiness arises from this letting go, from this opening, from this relaxing. Sometimes it arises from an external experience that brings pleasure, but pleasure is not the same as happiness. And it really would behoove us to kind of like explore that. How are they related but distinct? Not all happiness comes out of pleasure. But the more we are able to dip into this sense of well-being, the less likely we are to be thrown off by balance, thrown off balance by these eight worldly winds, praise and blame, gain and loss, pleasure and pain, fame and disrepute. And so one more way that there's a number of ways we can work with equanimity. Another way is to just practice with some of the wisdom practices and to remind ourselves, yeah, things do change. It's the nature of things to not be inherently satisfying, partly because they change. And so to borrow some of this wisdom that we know from other experiences that allows us to maybe relax and soften a little bit and to open, so that then we can sit on the hill and to see a little bit bigger, have a bigger vista, bigger view. Maybe you can imagine that you don't know how to swim and you fall in the water. And then you thrash around, right? If you don't know how to swim, of course you do. You feel like, okay, I gotta get out here. But if you have a life jacket on, then you can paddle around and find your way. You don't have this fear of, you know, drowning. So cultivating well-being or borrowing some wisdom can be a way, which can be some life jackets that can help us to have some equanimity. And no matter whether the water is cold or hot or just right. So joy, happiness, well-being help create the conditions for equanimity to arise. Equanimity is sometimes said to be a higher happiness because it allows for this steadiness in the face of whatever is happening. And then equanimity creates the conditions for letting go, which is said to be the highest happiness. So without this idea that this oppressive idea that we have to be happy all the time and that we have to have joy and all these things. Just in this talk, I wanted to connect this idea of happiness and equanimity. And then equanimity to liberation. So this idea that happiness is an integral part of our path. We can cultivate, we can roll around in it. There's no reason not to allow ourselves to be nourished by it. And then stick with it, with the practice, and allow it to kind of turn into a certain contentment, which can be a support for equanimity. That equanimity can be a support for letting go, which is support for greater and greater freedom, which, of course, is happiness. So here we go, kind of like this circle. So with that, I'd like to wish you all a wonderful Memorial Day. I didn't connect this necessarily to Memorial Day, but it occurred to me that, oh, today is Memorial Day. So wishing you all a wonderful evening. Thank you.